Clayton Eshelman's contribution to poetry over the last 25 years has been immense. As an editor of Caterpillar and now Sulphur, he's brought fresh new writers and dug roots of poetry of significance. Translator of Aimé Césaire, Artaud, César Vallejo, and prolific writer of his own poems. Currently, Black Sparrow has just in the last month come out with a selected poems of Clayton Eshelman, which we had hoped would be here tonight for this occasion. But alas, has been held up in the mail and should be available at Left Bank Books in the next day or two. And we're privileged and happy to have Clayton here for the first time in about 7 years in St. Louis, if my memory serves me well. And it's been a rough journey for him here, so please make him welcome and tell him you're going to be happy to listen to him. Clayton Eshelman.
Thank you. I was on one of those planes that takes off and then goes back, which gives you, you know, a very interesting. I was, Paul Blackburn's collected poetry was published about 3 months ago. A poet associated with the Black Mountain Poets, a man who died in 1971. And I was right at the point in the book in which Blackburn discovered that he had cancer in the fall of 1969, at the point that the plane turned around and went back to Los Angeles. And the combination was really very, very strange. I'm reading from a book called The Name in Canyon River, Selected Poems, 1960-85. I'm mainly going to read from the third section. Occasionally, poems have little footnotes on them to locate not terribly well-known sources that would be an impediment if you didn't pick it up immediately in the poem. So I'll try to sort of like tick those in to the poems. The backdrop of the third section of the book, which is poems mainly from about 1977-78 to 1983, is research that I've been doing since 1974 on the origin of art, at least as it seems to come to us today, in the upper Paleolithic painted caves in southwestern France, in the Dordogne and the Ariège, and in the Cantabrian area in northern Spain, between 32,000 and roughly 8,000 BC, at the end of the last ice age, why the autonomous imagination seemed to have been discovered. And there is this fantastic move from no image of the world at all to the beginning of an image. So in my fantasy of art, why, it's those people, those men, women, and children's shoulders that we stand on, not essentially Dante's or Shakespeare's. So I've been going back and forth to the Dordogne and trying to build up a feeling and an imaginal awareness of what the paintings are about. And so I'm going to read you 9 poems this evening. It should take about 45 or 50 minutes. And several of the poems bring in the caves, though they're not really descriptive. There's one piece I'm going to read you that is kind of a notebook notation that tries to give a sense of going into one particular cave that has a lot of difficult physical access in it. But in most cases, I'm trying to draw on the imaginal power, my fantasy. These are not like poems of history. And trying to bring them in as some sort of like agent in terms of writing poetry in America in the 80s. So the first piece I'm going to read you is several little short prose passages that attempt to place the work. It's called Placements. It's dedicated to Jerome Rothenberg. Anguish, adore, Le Portel. Body bent over jagged rock in ooze, crawling in dark to trace the button of itself, or to unbutton the obscure cage in which a person and an animal are copulas, or are they delinxing each other? Or are they already subject and predicate in the amniotic cave air, watching each other across the word barrier? The flesh? At arm's length, the image. My focus, the extent of my reach. Where I end, the other begins. Is not all art that genuinely moves us done in the dark against a wall? Olson's whisper, a prayer. Boundary, disappear. I squat in my mother's arch, eating. The black beckons, so I go crawling to I know not where. The terror of crawling within my own shoulder space is exceeded by the instinct that I might fully crawl out of the frame my mother dimensioned me with. But to continue is finally to return, doubled back on my umbilical possibility. It is on the way back that I scratch what might be thought of as the fact that since I ceased being an animal, I have not known what to do with myself. The beginning of the construction of the underworld takes place in upper Paleolithic caves. To identify this place under construction, I use the later Greek word Hades, and it is there that the first evidence of psyche that we can relate to occurs. To be in the cave is to be inside an animal, a womb. But to draw there is to seek another kind of birth, an adjustment to the crisis of the animal separating out of the human, or the fall. To be inside, to be hidden, to be in Hades, where the human hides in the animal. Since the hidden is bottomless, totality is more invisible than visible. Insistence on a totality in which life is totally visible is the anti-dream. Hades, deprived of his depths. Satan, attempting to establish a kingdom or death camp solely on earth. It took thousands and thousands of years, but we did create the abyss out of a seemingly infinite, elastic crisis, therio expulsion. And we've lived in a state of animal withdrawal ever since. The pictures in the abyss that flicker our sleep and waking are the fallout that shouted us into dot and line and from which we've been throwing up and throwing down ever since. What we project as abyss and into it are the guardians or sides of boundary, the parietal labor to bear Hermes, to give a limit to evasiveness, to contour meaning, to make connections. As species disappear, the upper Paleolithic grows more vivid. As living animals disappear, the first outlines become more dear, not as reflections of a day world, but as primal contours of psyche, the shaping of the underworld, the point at which Hades was an animal. The new wilderness is thus the spectral realm created by the going out of animal life and the coming in our time, of these primary outlines. Our tragedy is to search further and further back for a common non-racial trunk in which the animal is not separated out of the human while we destroy the turf on which we actually stand. Silence raving. Patters, paters, Apollo globes, sound, breaking up with silence, coals, I can still hear, entanglements of sense pools, the way a cave would leak perfume. In the Cro-Magnons went along its wet hide walls, as if a flower way in drew their leggy panspermatic bodies, spidering over bottomless hunches, groping toward Persephone's fate, to be quicksanded by the fungus pulp of Hades' purple hair exploding in their brains. They poured their foreheads into the coals and corrals zigzagged about in the night air. The animals led in crossed a massive vulva incised before the gate. The power that came up from it was paradise, the power the Cro-Magnons bequeathed to us to make an altar of our throats. The first words were mixed with animal fat. Wounded men tried to say who did it. The group was the rim of a to-be-invented wheel. Their speech was spokes looping over around the hub of the fire, its silk of us, its burn of them. Bop, we dip, you dip, we dip to you, you will dip to us. Dionysus. The plopping, pooling words stirred by the lyre gaps between the peaks of flame, water to fire, us to them. Foal-eyed, rubbery, they looped back into those caves whose walls could be strung between their teeth, the sticky soul material pulled to the sides by their hands. Ooh, what bone looms they sewed themselves into. Ah, what tiny male spiders they were on the enormous, capable of devouring them. Female, rock, elastic, word. I've made several trips to Czechoslovakia, one in 1976 and one in 1979. And this is a piece that is an attempt to kind of place a week in Prague in 1979 and to get at certain differences and certain sinister contours that is different than here. There's a brief note on the poem. And near the end of it, there's a kind of store called a Tusex, T-U-S-E-X, a Tusex store, which are government-operated luxury marts which require the use of special money, easily obtained by foreigners but difficult for those behind the Iron Curtain to come by. And the reference to Rilke is from a beautiful short prose piece of Rilke's called An Experience, which is in his selected prose works, published by New Direction in 1960. The piece has a certain kind of dramatic structure in which a particular incident that happened in medieval Prague is sort of immediately struck in the title, and then you don't hear anything about it for about a page and a half. And then at a certain point, the figure who's central speaks and hopefully swims into the satellite Soviet Prague environment of the late 70s. Master Hannes to his blindness. Inside Starnova Synagogue, deeply recessed stained glass, such tender colors, pastel pinks, greens, hammocked with cobwebs. The slump in Czech character draped by the Soviet net. The impenetrable dusk our headlights could not shine through coal mine dusk, Borinage ghost of Van Gogh, a grimed religious body on straw trying to worship its spirit up. Imagine a living coal mine veined across the land, streets finely fissured with soot, a net become membrane, a marbleization of the spirit to which each particle of the burned contributes. One says, the Soviet net. Then one smells and tastes the net. A waiter explains why the menu supreme de volaille was served chopped Chinese chicken. Quote, our people know this is supreme de volaille. Unquote. Under the net, in ways hidden to me, what do they know? Has the truth in the lifeline marbleized lies? Stunned before the vagueness of the sinister, one's mind seeks out the physical world as if the mallards meandering the greasy Voltava outside the Botel porthole had something to do with better. Don't start feeling sorry for a check, Millen cautioned, or you'll never stop. It is as if to think on Czechoslovakia is to extend the soot, to describe sensations, to participate in a totalitarianism of imagination, which is description, the literal ruling out the shades of place. But if some facts are not given, how can Master Hannes' address to his blindness be understood? If the reader does not know Hannes' beautiful astrological clock, know that Hannes was blinded by Prague people so that he could never duplicate the clock. How could Hannes' words spoken to me in a coffee shop after I had seen the clock be understood? Poets in Czechoslovakia are deprived of expressing their pain, are made to lie to publish. Where does the pain go that they're not expressing? In the same way that I cannot forgive the Nazis because I was not in their camps, I cannot know the pain of deprived expression. I can embrace Jan and Milan and feel the extent to which the bow has been drawn and sense the filings in the soot collecting along the unsent arrow shaft. I know another kind of pain, the anxiety that comes from knowing anything can be said, that cutting into is merely shaving, the poet is a kind of barber sanding the druidic off the giant who considers who is to live in Viet X. You cannot speak versus you can say anything and it does not matter. What is not permitted gnaws at the ears of those through whom the able to speak passes without effect. Does the ineffable lie between? Palm on a tree crotch by the ocean, Rilke felt the other side of nature as a quiet, stealing bliss. The other side of nature. Fear introjected until the mind gags. Shadow streets cheered by eyes cowled with, I suffer like you. And then Master Hannes speaks. For making time beautiful, I have been pressed to time, toll of the maggots stretching in my sockets. By the ledge of the Voltava, The heels of my palms press in stars, chubby star worms, unable to display their energies along these poplar-lined banks. I made a harp of time and hang from its strings, which they drew through my eyes, a stilled pendulum against the other side of human nature. At the combined press of Rilke's and Hannes's palms, something moves bliss to terror, canceling both, a kind of blister in which a man in a two-sex store is trying to buy his child something he does not need with foreign money he cannot have. A fistless man in a room without windows. There's an early Charles Olson poem called La Préface, which has a very interesting passage in it in which, without any subordination or verb even, he juxtaposes one of the great Upper Paleolithic caves, Altamira, with one of the most hideous of the death camps, Buchenwald. He sets them there, and it's given me pause for a long time as to what the connection, if there is one, is. Perhaps in the sense that the Upper Paleolithic caves were discovered for the most part in the 20th century, and so that you have this chilling irony of the discovery of the earliest imaginative construction in the history of mankind during the period of time in which the most awful deconstruction is taking place. Anyway, to try to somehow work with that friction between construction and deconstruction in that sense, this piece came out. It's called Permanent Shadow, which is to evoke the images of the shadows on the walls at Hiroshima. There is no connection between the death camps and Lascaux. But what if the souls of the living dead have been tortured to the extent that no other abode could contain them, other than that cul-de-sac that by its manganese ceases merely to be stone hiding, but turns in the very word abattoir, felling or hide of the cave, its fell, herd pouring across a wall-turned hide. The bridge, I imagine, those hunters constructed from the seal of themselves to the animals through which they were boring. These phrases keep backing into themselves, as if our condition now is hugely umbilical. A gorged boa is our passageway. Something that is swallowed whole is the messenger between the invisible and the visibly cannibalistic, as if the cap of Hades is a skull drinking bowl. And the brains I mouth, and the marrow I emphasize, that which seems central within the rings, the trident within Poseidon, the Jupiter within light, are contaminated by the indigestible. This fish hook I cannot metabolize. In the fall of 1980, my wife and I were back in the Dordogne looking at the caves again for about the fifth or sixth time. And while we were there, Bill Evans, the jazz pianist, died. I had a marginal relationship to Evans' music. I respected it, but it was not central to me. My jazz musician is Bud Powell, that I discovered in Indianapolis as a teenager, and has been for me the big figure in that particular realm of imagination, and still is. One day, hopefully, there will be really the due given Bud Powell that he deserves. Anyway, Bill Evans died at 51, and I knew a little bit about his background and his tortured junk-involved life, and the whole sense of the way that we hurt ourselves and help ourselves, or the way that somehow the artist, at least in the society that we live in, seems to be constantly in a state of balancing construction and deconstruction, began to sort of obsess me. And so I tried to write a piece sort of using some of the materials that were around us in the Dordogne, like field slugs and Amanita muscaria and various kinds of stuff that I was seeing around in the landscape, and then to ask some questions about the way that we hurt ourselves to somehow to stoke the creative and what this is about. It's called The Death of Bill Evans. 3-inch caramel-colored field slug on its back, vibrating by the scraps of a big Amanita muscaria. It has eaten more than its size, and now its true size and visionary trance makes me sad of my size. I can never eat enough of a higher order to trick the interior leper to the door, banish him. But what would remain if I were to become pure? Can't see the wound for the scars. A small boy composed of scabs is staring into the corner of his anatomy, where walls and floor end, he figures he ends. So he wears his end like glasses before his eyes. Beckoned into the snow, he will be beaten by children he thought were his friends. The implication of his hurt is so dark, it will scab over to be re-scabbed the next time. And he will grow, not by an internal urge to mature, but by scabbings, until grown big, he will be the size of an adult. And his face will look like a pebbly gourd. He will stay inside the little house I have built for him, in which to stand he must stoop. The death of Bill Evans makes me ask what tortured him so. Why did a man capable of astonishingly beautiful piano playing feed his leper hero wine? Or is the leper an excuse to modulate suffering just enough to keep one's warmth and danger at exactly the right odds? Eat Amanita-filled slug, I hear my death angel say. Put into yourself poison in order to know the taste of a wound that is bottomless, thus pure. And because pure, receptive to infection, once infected, open to purity, endlessly draining both. A wound in which you live like a slob and like a king. In which you hurt yourself because you really don't care. In which you care so much that you can't always keep caring. So you say, fuck it! And the gourd-faced leper, misinterpreting his rot for Dionysian exuberance, seems to drink or makes a certain sucking motion with the mouth area of his head. The next piece I'd like to read you is like sort of field notes. That take on a kind of a definite focus at points, especially near the end, but are really like notations done in a notebook in the way that writers keep notebooks and try to keep in contact with what they're doing and seeing, especially when they're involved in things that seem to be like research projects. This is called Notes on a Visit to Le Duc d'Audebert. Le Duc d'Audebert is a Paleolithic decorated cave in the Ariège. This is deep southern France near the Spanish border. And it's a cave that was discovered in 1916 by the same family that discovered a cave called the Trois Frères, the three brothers. The family still owns it. You can't go in it as a tourist if you're visiting France. You would have to contact the director, and then the director would have to make an appointment for you. The director, the regional prehistoric director. He would have to make an appointment with you, with the owner, and we had become friends with that particular director because we wanted to see the caves, and that's the only way you can get in. So we just happened to be in the area in 1980, and we called up our friend, and he said, well, you're lucky. He says, we're going into Le Tuc d'Audebert tomorrow. That's the only time we'll go in this year. So they take about 10 or 12 people in once a year. And the crawling area has been restricted to about 12, 14 inches with little strings tied along the broken-off stalactites. And so that there's the area to the left and the right, when there is area, is completely untouched. One of the things that happens when spelunkers or other people like the peasants that live out by the caves, one of the things that happens is they go in and without meaning to, they destroy the crawling area. And so they lose fingerprints and all sorts of indications of life, you know, sometimes, you know, 25, 30,000 years ago. So Le Tuc d'Audebert is probably one of the most protected, and it's also physically a difficult cave to visit. It takes about 7 hours to get in and out of. It's around 900 meters, 9 football fields. It has an underground river that flows under it, and you go up rather than down. It's located in a hill. And the drive in visiting the cave is to get to the very end of the cave after this torturous crawl and climb, in which there are two bison about this big, sculpted out of clay, a male and a female, leaned against a rock. It's the first standing sculpture. They're supposedly sculpted at around 18,000 BC. And they're leaned against a rock in the last chamber, and the male appears to be about ready to mount the female. And that's in the very end, and one sort of goes to that, sees that, crawls around it, and then comes back out. The next morning, I was very excited. This was one of the most exciting experiences of my life, to visit Le Tuc d'Audebert. And I just sat down and very quickly wrote out 6 or 7 pages of notes in my notebook. And this is what I decided, well, I just leave these and not try to work them up or, you know, do anything to them. So they're notes. Bundled by Tuc's tight, jagged corridors, flocks of white stone tits, their milk and long stone nipply drips frozen over. The underground volp in which the enormous guardian eel, now unknown, lies coiled. To be impressed by this primordial theater of cruelty, by its keelhaul sorcery. Volp mouth, the tongue of the river lifting one in. To be masticated by Le Tuc d'Audebert's cruel stones, the loom of the cave. Up the oblique chimney to ladder to iron cleats set in the rock face to the cat hole on one stomach to crawl, working against one, pinning one as the earth into it to makes one feel for an instant, feel its traction, the dread of withering in place, pinned in, the meat server, masticated by the broken chariot of the earth. Fantastic figures, more beast-like here than human, one horn, one ear, one large figure, one small figure, as in Lascaux, the grand and petit sorcerer, first indications of master apprentice,
Tanist from Graves? The grotesque archetype. Vortex in which the emergent human and withdrawing animal are spun. Grotesque equals movement. Life is grotesque when we catch it in quick perceptions, at full vent, history shaping itself. The turns, twists of the cave reinforce the image turbine, as does the underground river. The cave floats, in a sense, in several senses, all at once. It rests on the river, is penetrated by it, was originally made by rushing water. The cave is the skeleton of flood. Images on its walls participate thus as torsion in an earlier torsion. Here one might synthesize: one, abstract signs initiate movement brought to rest in, three, naturalistic figures, bison, horses, etc. In between the friction are, two, grotesque hybrids. Useful, but irrelevant to systematized forces that must have been felt as flux, as unplanned, spontaneous, as were the spots, areas, and caves chosen for images. Because shadowing or wall contour evoked an animal? Any plan a coincidence? We have no right to systematize an area of experience of which we have only shattered iceberg tips. Yet it does seem that image occurs at the point that a naturalistic horse is gouged in rock across an abstract vulva already gouged there, so that the rudiments of poetry are present at approximately 30,000 BC. Image is crossbreeding, or the refusal to respect the single individuated body. Image is that point where sight crosses sight. To be alive as a poet is to be in conversation with one's eyes. What impresses at Touques is a relationship between river, hybrid figures, and the clay bison. It is as if the river, the skeleton of water equals the cave itself, erupts into image with the hybrid guardians and is brought to rest in the terminal chamber with the two bison. That is, naturalism is a kind of rest. Naturalism returns us to a continuous and predictable nature, though there is something unnatural about those two bison to be noted later. Takes us out of the discontinuity, the transgression, to cite Bataille's slightly too Catholic term, of the grotesque. Though the grotesque on another level, according to Bakhtin, is deeper continuity, the association of realms, kingdoms, fecundation and death, degradation and praise. Today take to be the way things are. Though with ecological pollution, generation leads to mutation, a new grotesque. To be gripped by a womb of stone, to be in the grip of the surge of life imprisoned in stone. It is enough to make one sweat one's animal. Having left the, what the French call, nuptial hall of white stone breasts in which one can amply stand, the breasts hang in clusters right over one's head, one must then squirm vertically up the spiral chimney or use the current iron ladder to enter the upper level via a cat hole into a corridor through which one must crawl on hands and knees. Then another longish cat hole through which one must crawl on one's belly, squirming through a human-sized tunnel to a corridor through which one can walk haltingly, stooping, occasionally slithering through vertical cat slits and straddling short walls. If one were to film one's postures through this entire process, it might look like a St. Vitus dance of the stages in the life of man, birth channel, expulsion to old age, but without chronological order, a jumble of exaggerated and strained positions that correspondingly increase the image pressure in one's mind. While on the Tuk Dodaber, I felt the broken horse rear in agony in the cave-like stable of Picasso's Guernica. At times, I wanted to leave my feet behind or to continue headless in the dark. My stomach desired prawn-like legs with grippers. My organs were in the way. Something inside of me wanted to be an armored worm, one feeler extending out its head. I swear I sensed the disintegration of the backbone of my mother, now buried 12 years. Entangled in a cat hole, I felt my tongue start to press backwards, and the image force was I wanted to choke myself out of myself, to give birth to my own strangulation, and then nurse my strangulation at my own useless male breasts. Useless? No. For Le Tuc Dodaber unlocks memories that bear on a single face the expressions of both Judith and Holofernes at the moment of beheading, mingled disgust, terror, delight, and awe. One is stimulated to enter, desire to enter cavities within oneself where dead men can be heard talking. In Le Tuc Dodaber, I heard something in me whisper me to believe in God, and something else in me whispered that the command was the rasp of a 6,000-year-old man who wanted to be venerated again. And if what I'm saying here is vague, it is because both voices had to sound themselves in the bowels of this most personal and impersonal stone in which sheets of myself felt themselves corrugated with nipples, as if the anatomy of life could be described from this perspective as entwisted tubes of nippled stone through which perpetual and mutual beheadings and birthings were taking place. But all these fantastic images were shooed away the moment I laid eyes on the two bison sculptured out of clay leaned against what had fallen from the chamber ceiling. The bison and their altar seemed to be squeezed up into view out of the swelling of the chamber floor. The sense of culmination was very severe. The male about to mount the female, but clearly placed several inches behind and above her, not in contact with any part of her body, and he had no member. If they were coupling and without deep cracks in their clay bodies, they would have disappeared into their progeny thousands of years ago. But here they are today, still, as if Michelangelo were to have depicted God and man as not touching, but only reaching towards each other, caught in the exhaustion of a yearning for a sparking that has in fact never taken place. So that the weight of all the cisterns in the world is in that yearning, and the weight of that yearning is the real ballast in life, a ballast in which the unborn are coddled like slowly cooking eggs, unborn bison and unborn man, in the crib of a scrotum, a bone scrotum, that jailhouse of generation from which the prisoners yearn to leap onto the taffy machine-like pistons of shaping females. It is that void where the leap should occur that Le Tuc Dodaber says is void. And that unfilled space between two fertile poles here feels like the origin of the abyss, as if in the minds of those who shaped and placed those two bison, fertilization was pulled free. And that freedom from connection is the demon of creation haunting man and woman ever since. We crawled on hands and knees about this scene, humbled in single file, lower than the scene. 11 human creatures come, lamps in hand, like a glowworm pilgrimage, to to worship in circular crawl at one of the berths of the abyss. If I'd stayed longer, if I'd not with the others disappeared into the organic odors of the Montesquieu Avante woods, I'm sure that I would have noticed flittering out of the deep cracks in the bison clay little winged things, image babies set free, the Odyssey before Odysseus, who still wander the vaults of what we call art, seeking new abysses to inscribe with the tuning forks of their wings. First chunk of, I'll read three more pieces. Couple are rather short. This goes into more recent work of 84-85. The first chunk of this is literally, with a couple of little slight adjustments on my part, a piece of mail that I received in 1983. It's called Junk Mail. I've been invited to the Third Creativity and Madness Conference, Easter week, 1984, at the Sheraton Royal Waikoloa. After Pablo Picasso, the blue, the rose, the cubist, the magnificent, with three exclamation marks, there will be a singles luncheon, Dutch treat, followed 4 hours later by a piano concert of Chopin and Brahms by Mrs. Ostwald, presumably the wife of Peter F. Ostwald, M.D., author of Music and Madness, the inner voices of Robert Schumann, who will, just before the singles luncheon, have lectured on music ambivalence and bachelorhood. Tuesday, April 17th, will start off with a bang. After Bauman Scholever's Descent into Hell, Basic Mistrust and Ego Despair in the Poetry of Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, Dr. and Mrs. Carter will present A Marital Crisis as Revealed in the Music and Art of Arnold Schoenberg. After Charlie Chaplin, A Life Observed, there will be a Sheraton Royal Waikoloa Roundup dinner and show, optional. After Dr. Scholever has displayed Dante Alighieri's Ascent to Heaven, the movie The Tempest will be shown. A previous conferee commented, creativity and madness was enjoyable in every conceivable way. The difficulty of creativity and the despair of madness have been dumped into a trough called enjoyment. Fun is the word, I think, for what the participants are geared for. Not Maenads raving on the endless sticks of a threadbare psyche, nor even a scrutiny of how the thread might have disappeared in its appearance to John Wieners or Diane Arbus. To place an and between creativity and madness sets up a momentary LSD icicle in whose blade a glorious disorder sticks out its tongue, or the not inaccurate hunch that in creative grandeur another world is manifest. And when one finds oneself waiting for days in a lagoon of blood with no sun, no moon, but only a roaring as of surf around one, one must have the candle of one's split open mind, or all that we seek to leave, but so depend upon for meaning, is engulfed. But what could those of us who have had our arm around Nebuchadnezzar once, who have at least been penetrated by the smell of crawling in a gibbous circle in a dark hut, what can we say to those who would season their Royal Waikoloa singles luncheon with George Orwell and Rudyard Kipling abandoning parents and abusing children? There is a repression in North American psyche so tough, so uncontactable because of the depth now of the suffering midden of humanity creating goods for us, that it is no longer disturbable. It can enjoy anything, can enjoin any grief and discuss it over pineapple. But I cannot fully believe this, or I too would be consumed. That the shirts of these people are being made somewhere in the world where the workers live less well than our pets can turn the vice of the creative mind into itself to the point that not madness, but a simpering, descriptive situation comedy runs out. A pseudo-art, the equivalent of the lectures to be delivered there. And how much of those doctors and their well-healed patients are packed like a chamber of bullets in my own mind. For I can actually see myself enjoying being there. I'd blow up 48 hours after arrival, but my gregarious North American nature is so social, it dives into any human pool with the drunken recklessness with which I used to leap with friends into the Bloomington quarries in utter blackness at 3 a.m., knowing we'd be, if lucky, missing jagged rocks 30 feet down by a few feet. I say to this nature, I know how powerful you are, how ego-potent your lust to protect and propitiate your so-called innocence. In the soulless basement of this country, it is you who are at play, ceaselessly reassembling the heating system, occasionally braining your puppy with your little wood mallet. Amazed and delighted, he springs back to life. Amazed and delighted that mother and father are out on endless chores. Daddy over Nicaragua loosing last night's supper. We don't know where mommy is. She may be at the market or at choir practice, but her condition is we don't know where she is. So little me looks around with glazed, wild-eyed friendliness. Maybe he should go look for her. But when me looks for something, it does not go out. It only goes into a more me-ish aspect of itself. It reclines on the basement floor, unzips its little pants, and pulls out like magician streamers the cloth of its own hunting scenes, timeless yet timed, edged with a sportive fuse. Nothing, charmed from its nickel dungeon, eyes this little fellow like we frat rats used to eye a frightened, unsure, slightly ugly, clearly needy girl. The next poem has a tiny note from a wonderful book by Peter Redgrove and Penelope Shuttle called The Wise Wound, which is the first real study on a medical as well as mythological level of menstruation that I've ever read. It was published in 1978. The term, which is the title of the poem, is Mythuna. There's actually an Octavio Paz poem by the same title. And the definition of Mythuna, or the thing that I'm working here with, comes from the Wise Wound book. It is in this afterglow, after sex, that the things of God are revealed. The tantrics call it Mythuna. And this is something that came into me as a kind of a placement for an experience that I'd had for a number of years. I had gone into Reichian therapy in the late 60s in New York, and it had loosened me up considerably as having been a rather hostile, embedded kind of creature from Indiana. And I had realized that at the point after lovemaking, that there's a period of a half an hour or 45 minutes when I relaxed and stayed with the person I was with, in which my mind was really flooded. At first, I sort of disregarded this because I wasn't prepared for it or looking for it. And I became aware over the years that it was actually the point in which I was like dreaming awake, and in which there was all of the seeds of the things that I wanted to work with. And so at the point that I read Peter and Penelope's book, and they gave a title or they gave a name to this particular moment, then I tried to do something with it. Mythuna. Carol's delicate hand reaching in sleep my side, out of which a turbulent river pours, to sheathe her hand and arm, to cocoon, protect her. And in doing so, lying awake, I watch her grow monstrous, a creature of my imagining, her body wet, feathery with slime. Now I'm wrapping her as if with long silken vegetal bands, binding her with the freedom of my side, spear place, gore transformed into a vault of liquid thread, spool vault in which the swastika of aggression is dissolved by a harem of tentacles into this magical moonlit thread. So, do I hesitate as if from fear of the labyrinth of syntax binding you binds me into? Already only your heart can be seen, the truffle center of a winding that even wound tight is loose and curling, a train of cloth draped about the rocks over which I am crawling with you stitched to my back. So there is no ending to the shrine, constantly fastening and unhooking, for I've seen the husks of your eyes at night littered about the world, still glinting with the nickel mystery of the interior, still moist, although all the flesh about them has been eaten by the likes of me. Is it eons ago? Or did I just a moment ago convert my kissing into infantile hunger and with all my teeth turned into penises break up and suck in your soft, soft tofu interior? I must have. Yet you are still outside and radiant in this after intercourse mythuna. Through the translucent bindings, I can see you slowly begin to form your own world. In your flipper-like hands, you hold a glass ball in which is reflected the face of creation. For having penetrated you, I have been offered Sabbath. Our bed is crisscrossed with rainbows, blood-edged with violet interiors. The warthogs have stopped their horrible breathing. For a moment, the whiskey mattress in Alexander Haig's voice collapses. Heaps of disemboweled peasants rot into it, and the world is fungus with vermicular elves busily shoveling and restoring. And now, as you expose me to the hexagonal formation of hovering wasps, I receive the discharge of eggs, loading them in here, kissing an identity to each. Miraculous conversion of my plight from having left the mat of tusks and the bright red mouth of writhing hair. To move into the image of you as through eelgrass, to hold in outstretched hands the torn pods of your ice age distant eyes, to feel the iris pulse and implode, to watch the warthogs take off their tusks, empty them of powder, even unscrew their hooves, packing themselves into the lining of my wound. Lastly, the color rake of time. I dreamed that all artists were friends, that we told everything we knew to each other, and that our knowledge was physical, that we worked in the skull rooms of each other's genital enclosures, broken fulcrum people, reigning within ourselves at high noon, that we talked in mid-ocean and smashed saint stables where spars were severe steady cave-ins, that at last all of us feasted off repression and depression. I dreamed that the Sphinx was not at the end of her twig, that she was not open to the furnace of the hearth, that there was no heat without recall, no vitality without memory, that the slave was merely one who rode in a hold without oarlock. Then I heard the color rake of time scraping the window and awoke to the face of God, whose childhood is everlasting, whose maturity we struggle to create. Thank you.